blessed with a sense of absurdity, journalist and satirist Paul Krasner was once characterized by the FBI as a raving, unconfined nut. He liked that and incorporated those words into the title of his revised autobiography, Confessions of a Raving, Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture. Krasner wrote a lot about his personal philosophy, so when we spoke by phone on November 24, 2012, from his home near Palm Springs, California, we began our conversation when I asked him to tell us about his philosophy, what it is, and how it came to be.
Trying to do the appropriate thing every moment, but I have to add that it's what's appropriate to me, because what's appropriate to me isn't to others, and vice versa. So I try to be as objective as possible, and in that context, I try to rationalize as little as possible. I pay a lot of attention to myself because I don't have a regular job, so I can't be caught goofing on the job, because in those moments, I examine my motivation for making a decision, and I can understand the motivation of others and watch how they rationalize what they do, and that's been helpful to me, not only as just an individual, but also as a writer, because which is why it's good that I don't have a recognition that people see me walking in the street, hardly at all. So that because if you're famous in that sense, then you can't be an observer so much if you're the one that's being observed. So my philosophy is kind of just being in awe of the mystery. I don't believe any conscious deity exists, although I'm just perverse enough to have conversations with the deity I don't believe in. And it's just a kind of touchstone for objectivity.
Is the deity with whom you have conversations conscious or unconscious?
Oh, well, in my case, it's conscious conversation. I do it to help keep me honest. Whereas somebody like Pat Robertson uses his communication with God to help him remain dishonest. And the best example of that is just recently, after the election, he apologized that he didn't listen to God carefully enough when God told him that Mitt Romney was going to win. So he's doing that to protect his ego and his image, people's relationships with the deity that they believe in are always subjective. I mean, you know, it's like when I feel that whenever people pray, they're talking to themselves. And I'm not judging that. You know, sometimes prayer is the only thing that people feel they can do to handle a situation. So even though I started out as a militant atheist, I've mellowed out in the sense that in the 60s that was the change for me. I realized that Martin Luther King was a Christian, and I really admired his acts as a leader and dedicated to justice. Whereas George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party, called himself an agnostic, and I abhorred his philosophy and his what he would like to have turned into, Holocaust, the sequel.
Well, you describe philosophy as the rationalization of life.
That wasn't my description. That was the professor in philosophy 101. But I adapted it as my own. The way I feel, and it's maybe a case of my false humility, but I believe that life is a mystery, and if it's not a mystery, what the bleep is it? Because all the people who talk about a deity don't really describe what they mean, and I can understand. I can even understand Christianity in the sense that the concept of God is inconceivable. It's like trying to conceive of time, if it had no beginning and no end. At what time did it start? it's bizarre. It's just a purely individual tactic to deal with the mystery. I used to be obsessed with it, and now I just enjoy it.
Well, let's go back in time, maybe to one of the early events that you mention in your book of confessions, about when you were characterized as a child prodigy playing the violin at age 6 in Carnegie Hall, balanced on one foot while you were playing without missing a beat, scratching your other foot. Certain thoughts I sense came to your mind about dealing with the world.
Well, it wasn't a thought, it was a feeling. The feeling was the itch. I mean, I had started playing the violin when I was 3 years old, and I don't remember that, but that's what I was told. And I practiced myself out of my childhood for 3 years. And so at the age of 6, when I played in Carnegie Hall, I was still asleep in a certain sense. You know, I mean, people can go into their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s and be asleep, but manage to, it's like the whole world is on Ambien, and they sleep, but then they do things that they're not really examining and being and questioning what they do. So the point is that my leg itched, and I have been trained as a professional little violinist, not to stop in the middle of the Vivaldi concerto and scratch my left leg with my bow. So I knew, without thinking about it, that I had to find an alternative method. And so that's when, without thinking about it, but the image of doing it was to stand on my left leg and scratch it with my right foot without missing a note of the Vivaldi concerto, in A minor, by the way. And I was a minor at the time, so it seemed appropriate. But that moment when I made the choice to do that act, it made the audience laugh. And that's what really woke me up, because I was just trying to solve a little personal problem. But the audience interpreted it as humor. So I think that's when I first understood, without even having the vocabulary for it, that one person's logic is another person's humor.
Essentially, you've made a career, a profession, out of manipulating logic into humor.
The way I had put it before you said that was that it's the difference between a truth and a satirical extension of the truth. But I think it means the same thing. It's like the truth is a piece of clay that you kind of molded in your hands into a satirical extension of the original clay. I mean, it is that. More and more, though, because the news is getting more and more bizarre itself. I think sometimes that I'm writing the news now, and I can't even believe that. And so reality has been nipping on the heels of satire for the last several decades. and has finally caught up with it and even outrun satire. So one example that comes to mind is it happened in Waco, Texas, when David something had his cult, and the attorney general had tank fire, set it on fire, and while the fire was going on, with the people inside, with the cult members, including children, were inside, Jay Leno on The Tonight Show, in his monologue, Leno said that the members of the cult, there were two kinds of them, regular and crispy. It was an interesting image, but and who's to say what's too soon? But I think that's the first time I recall it not even being too soon, but simultaneously was the reality and the stretching of it.
You characterize your God-given talent to be a professional brat. I'm curious as to how you would define a brat.
A brat would be when I was at playing the violin at a concert in upstate New York. I think it was Mount Kisco, I think it was. And there was a pianist who played the piano on the stage, and I had this impulse. It was not a good impulse, but it was an impulse. And my sense of empathy had not developed much yet. And so I pulled the curtain down on the pianist while he was in the middle of his concert piece there. And what happened was I was supposed to get $20, and they didn't pay me. And I felt that was an injustice because I played for $20, you know, and it was like they would give me a $20 fine for pulling the curtain down. But anyway, the point is that by pulling the curtain down, that was a bratty thing to do. And by a lot of the stuff that I published in The Realist, it just made me be a professional brat.
Well, let's see if we can fit this into what you characterize as a pathological resistance to authority in relationship to never having burned your draft card, but I think you participated in something similar to that.
Oh, well, it wasn't that I didn't burn my draft card so much as I was speaking at campuses. This was during the Vietnam War, and I wanted to make a point how people could get all upset about burning a piece of cardboard while they were looking the other way at burning civilians on the other side of the globe with napalm. So I just used that act. So what I did was I would burn a photostat of my draft card at each campus. And then I did it at the expo in Montreal. I was in the U.S. pavilion. And they had a Marine who had been trained in protocol there, like the guard, and I was being interviewed by CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And when it came to the point where I felt it was appropriate, I said that I was going to burn my draft card. And of course, the interviewer said, "Oh, I think I have a scoop here." You know, that was how he envisioned it. And so the Marine called his captain, who came over, and he said, "The lieutenant says that you burned your draft card there." And I said, "No, I didn't." And he said, "Sir, I saw him, sir. I saw him. He burned it." I said, "No, look." And I took my draft card out, the real one, and showed it to him. And the lieutenant was very mystified. I said, "I burned a photostat of my draft card." And the captain said to me, "Well, don't you know that burning a draft card or making a what they called it. It used to be what they said on cereal, but when you would send a coupon or a facsimile, he said, "Don't you know it's against the law to make a facsimile of your draft card?" And I explained to him that I had burned the evidence. I had destroyed it. So, you know, that was a bratty thing to do, but it was just my nature.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Paul Krasner about his revised autobiography, Confessions of a Raving, Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Well, let's move on to some of the people who are influences in your life. You talk a lot about Lenny Bruce. How did Lenny Bruce influence your life as a satirist?
First of all, when I started doing stand-up, I was using my old violin as a prop. And the first joke I did was to ask the audience, what song did Eve sing to Adam in the Garden of Eden? And then I would play on the violin, "Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree" with anybody but me. And I was using the name Paul Mall, which got a laugh, and then everything went downhill. So Lenny Bruce suggested, A, that I drop the violin, and this I just use my own name, or get a better name that doesn't seem so contrived. Anyway, it was the beginning of a friendship, and then when I got assigned to interview him, I met him at in Ohio, I think it was, where he was performing at a club, and I traveled around with him for a while, and I watched the way he performed, and if I said something that he really liked, he would say, "Can I have that?" You know, and then he would integrate that into his performance. And so watching him, I felt that I still had not matured as a comedian. I was still experimenting with, you know, my attitude. For a while, I wore a bebop hat and was trying to come like a hipster, but it wasn't me. I was still experimenting. And I saw Lenny just being himself, and I thought, that's all I need to do. And
so what did you do to change to become yourself?
To return to that, yeah, because it was a very self-conscious thing to go on a stage in front of a bunch of strangers and know that you had a responsibility to make them laugh. And so there was that. It wasn't like something you could just memorize and play by rote, like I did with the violin. This I had to be creative, and one of the most gratifying responses I got to publishing The Realist was from George Carlin, who said that he was doing the hippy dippy weatherman and other things, and going, going to Las Vegas and doing shows for where he didn't seem he fit in that, and. So he was inspired by the kind of stuff I published about not only my own stuff, but by other artists and writers who were being themselves. And so we, you know, we broke one taboo after another. And so he said that he could not read The Realist without changing himself. And so the fact that my work inspired him, and the fact that his work have inspired so many others that never heard of me is very gratifying.
You are credited with the phrase in criminal law of the Twinkie defense. And now that the Hostess Cupcake Company is going bankrupt, what do you think of the Twinkie defense?
Well, I just wrote a long piece about it, which your listeners can just look it up in Huffington Post. It was titled "The Behind the Twinkie Defense." They had several psychiatrists testifying, trying to prove that Dan White, the ex-policeman who shot and killed San Francisco Mayor George Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk. Martin Blinder, the psychiatrist, said that he spent the previous night binging on Twinkies and junk food. So that was a specific name he gave it. So I just was taking my notes there on my pad, and I just wrote down Twinkie defense. And then I was covering the trial for the alternative weekly there, the San Francisco Bay Guardian. So I just mentioned that in my next report. And did a little research to the bakery company. I asked. I found out that the shelf life of Twinkie was 7 years. And I think that Dan White was sentenced for a double execution, political execution. I think he got 5 years. So that when he left prison, that Twinkie on his shelf would still be edible. Although I think he probably bronzed it.
Well, Paul Krasner, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, can you tell us about a eureka or an aha moment that affected your life? Perhaps you disdain, or perhaps you have adopted as a philosophy of life?
The worst thing that has ever happened to me, after the trial of Dan White, I was in my home, smoking a joint and writing my final, after the verdict had come in, and writing my final piece on for the Bay Guardian, when I got a call from Mike Weiss, who has written the book about the trial, and he was writing for Rolling Stone and the Washington Post, I think. He called me and he said, you better get down here. There's a riot outside City Hall. So stoned as I was, I knew what my responsibility was to myself and to the paper and to the readers. And so I called a cab and went down there. And the police were all locked inside City Hall. And while their cars were being set on fire and you could hear the sirens going, and they were absolutely furious. And the door had been blocked with a strong piece of wood going through the handles of the outside door. And they had been told by the police, by their chief, to wait until the next shift came. Meanwhile, and so when they finally got out, they ran out into the streets with their billy clubs, cursing at... it was essentially a gay riot that was taking place, understandably, because Harvey Milk was their hero. You know, had he lived, he probably would have been the first gay mayor and gone on and on. He was the gay equivalent to Martin Luther King in the sense of leadership and being an activist, not just an easy chair leader. And two cops beat me with a billy stick. And as a result, my gait and my posture and everything, it changed me. And I made the mistake of not getting any physical therapy or suing even. But it was year after year, my condition got worse. And I ended up using a cane and now sometimes when I go out, a walker. And it was it was triggered by that. And it changed my life for the worse. I've learned to live with it because, you know...
The alternatives to living with it are grave.
Yes, exactly. I would rather be crippled and ecstatic to be alive than not being a crippled but not being alive.
So that brings me to the next question. You're going to be 81 years old in the spring of 2013, and what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
I've learned the importance and the necessity of family and friends, and I have both, and... I think it's a disease that I buy books and don't read them. I have a lot of books, too many ever to read in the remaining years. But I do want to read the, it'll be interesting picking out the ones that I do want to read. But also I want to write three novels. I think you know, it's a challenge. I've never written fiction before. There's a friend of mine, Avery Corman, a novelist who wrote Oh God and Kramer versus Kramer, both of which became movies. And he wrote his first article for The Realist, actually. And so I said to him, yeah, boy, it's really hard to write a novel. You have to make everything up. And he said, come on, Paul, you've been making up stuff all your life. And I said, yeah, but that was journalism.
So then, with that said, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
One of the first, earliest books I read, which was Johnny Got His Gun by Dalton Trumbo. It was about a soldier in World War One who had lost, he was blind, deaf, had no sense of smell or taste. The only thing left was his sense of touch, and so, you know, he could feel if a breeze came through the hospital window, or if he was sweating, or if a nurse touched him. And so even though it was an anti-war book, what got me was it illuminated the sense of consciousness for me, and also the way it was written was the first half of it was how he discovered his condition, because he couldn't tell the difference between dreaming and being awake. And then when he finally discovered his condition, the second half was what he was going to do about it. And so that was a book that had a big influence on me. I was afraid that everything after that would be anticlimactic.
Well, Paul Krasner, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Barry, it's been a true pleasure. You stimulated me. Now I won't be able to get any sleep tonight, just basking in the afterglow. Thanks for inviting me once again.
Paul Krasner was characterized by the FBI as a raving, unconfined nut and included those words in the title of his revised autobiography, The Confessions of a Raving, Unconfined Nut, Misadventures in the Counterculture. The book that Paul Krasner recommends is Johnny Got His Gun, by Dalton Trumbo. This program was recorded on November 24th, 2012. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Our address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.